Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What happens after a revolution? No matter how Hosni Mubarak leaves office in Egypt, a presidential election is now scheduled for September, in which Mubarak and his son Gamal say they will not run. And today comes word via CNN that Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood movement also says it will not field a candidate for president. An interesting development if they stick to it, considering the trepidations about any Islamist political group coming from the West and from Israel, and considering that the Muslim Brotherhood is considered to have about 25% of Egyptians probably in their camp to start out. Our first guest today is a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood in Kenya who has since become world-renowned for her staunch opposition to Islamist politics. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Somali-born, was a refugee in Kenya during her Muslim Brotherhood teen years in the 80s, went on to become a member of parliament in the Netherlands, and was the screenwriter for Theo van Gogh's film Submission, over which van Gogh was assassinated. The film was critical of Islam's treatment of women. Ayaan Hirsi Ali now lives in the United States, is a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, is starting a foundation here in New York with the John Jay College for Criminal Justice to protect women and girls from activities inspired by political Islam. Her book, Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations, is just out in paperback, and she has an article in the International Herald Tribune and on Huffington Post called Get Ready to Compete with the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt Could Chart a Third Way. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, thanks so much for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Tell us more about your teenage membership in the Muslim Brotherhood in Kenya in 1985. What religion or religious or political beliefs did you hold at the time that led you to join?
Well, the first remarkable thing about it is what the term membership meant. It wasn't a formal membership that you pay a membership fee for in an organization that is structured like, say, the various Christian organizations in the West. It was being a member of a movement. And from being Muslim, so identifying myself as a Muslim in the spiritual sense, limiting my faith to prayer and fasting and so on, we gradually, as students, moved to the political aspect of Islam. I learned as a teenager more about terms like jihad or the holy war to divide the world into the house of Islam and the house of war. And my duty as a young Muslim woman was to invite, through da'wah, to invite non-Muslims to Islam. And if they refused, I had to do all I could, curse them in my prayers and eventually even take up arms, which wasn't relevant for me at the time as a 15-year-old. But that is, and then another remarkable thing about that time was our learned hatred of Jews and Jewish people when we had no Jews or Jewish people in our neighborhoods or in our countries. So there was a politicization of the faith that made us belong to a movement again. And I think the Muslim Brotherhood has evolved since then, but has not changed its objectives at all.
Not changed its objectives at all. So you think there is a relevance to the experience that you had as a teenager in Kenya 26 years ago to understanding the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood today?
Well, yes. First of all, the Muslim Brotherhood was founded in Egypt and spread to the rest of the world. And the main objective was to aspire to a society, a nation, a world that is ruled through Islamic law, by Islamic law or Sharia law. That objective has not changed. What has changed is an internal discussion within the movement on when and how to use violence. And I think the prevailing attitude within the Muslim Brotherhood now is that the movement can gain its objectives through nonviolent means, and particularly in elections, which is a narrow definition, a very narrow definition of democracy. The extreme violent ones are groups like Al-Qaeda and Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan, but they have sort of diverged in a different side. And I think that is what makes the Muslim Brotherhood elusive and in a way far more dangerous than Al-Qaeda because of their ability to participate in a democratic system, even though they have undemocratic objectives, and make everybody believe that it is that they are peaceful and that they will morph into something like the Christian democratic parties in Europe.
Let me read you this CNN report and get your reaction. As far as I can tell, they're the only news organization reporting this so far. But it says, keeping with the low profile it has adopted in Egypt's uprising, the Muslim Brotherhood said Wednesday it wants to promote democracy but does not intend to field a candidate for president. Quoting Mohamed Morsi, a member of the group's media office, quote, the Muslim Brotherhood are not seeking power. We want to participate, not to dominate. We will not have a presidential candidate. We want to participate and help. We are not seeking power. We reject the religious state. All of that attributed, actually most of that attributed to Mohamed Morsi, a member of the group's media office at a Cairo news conference. That last sentence, we reject the religious state, is a quote from Mohamed Khatatni, former head of the Muslim Brotherhood's parliamentary bloc, according to CNN. So what do you think of that? Are you familiar with either of those individuals? And if accurate as reported, here is a Muslim Brotherhood news conference saying they won't run a presidential candidate and reject a religious state.
I'm not familiar with either of the individuals. I'm familiar with the mission statement of the Muslim Brotherhood. And everywhere where they have taken part in elections, they have sought to dominate. Now, that may have changed or it may not have changed. I think it's far more interesting to seek a third way, a way of mobilizing and organizing and resourcing the liberal, secular individuals that are now, and groups that are now on Tahrir Square, and that is going to take a long, long time so that they can create civic and economic networks that can compete with the networks that the Muslim Brotherhood has.
Yes, and I want to get to some of the details of your article on Huffington Post and in the International Herald Tribune, how to compete with the Muslim Brotherhood. But one more thing about assessing them, because many observers are more sanguine about the Muslim Brotherhood than you are, saying that, you know, that Sharia law would not be their platform. Let me play you a clip of our guest from the other day, and since you come at this to some degree as a feminist, maybe you're familiar with the renowned Egyptian feminist, Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi. She's been among the protesters. She calls herself secular and not a supporter of the Brotherhood. But listen to about a minute of Dr. El-Sadawi on our show.
And you know, I am very secular. And the millions of women and men I met in Tahrir Square and in the streets, because I started with them on the 25th January till today, till this minute. The majority of them are secular young men and women, secular. Some of them belong to the Muslim Brothers. But many young Muslim Brothers are different from their leaders. They are much more broad-minded. They came to me. I was astonished. They came to me, hundreds of them, and they hugged me in Tahrir Square. And they told me, we may differ with you in some of the matter, opinion, but we love you and respect you. And we believe that the constitution of Egypt should be secular, that women and men should be equal. No, Christians and Muslims should be equal. So the younger generations of the Muslim Brothers, so we are not at all afraid of them.
So Ayan Hirsi Ali, do you know of Dr. El-Sadawi, and what do you make of that statement?
I have not met Dr. El-Sadawi in person. I have read her books, and I know of her reputation as a renowned feminist. Listening to this, I am not reassured. I would be more reassured if the record of the Muslim Brotherhood in various countries was different. We have seen time and again, members of the prominent members of the Muslim Brotherhood speak from both sides of their mouth. When it suits them, they will say they are pro-democratic and secular, and they will respect and enforce equal rights between men and women, between religious minorities and Muslims, and so on. But once they get a foothold, once they get to a place of power, we have seen quite the opposite. And countries like Afghanistan and even the writing of the Iraqi constitution, Egypt itself, Hamas, everywhere where the Muslim Brotherhood or groups that share the same objectives as the Muslim Brotherhood get to a place of domination, they change their colors, they change their objectives, and they stick to their mission. So I wouldn't trust that at face value. Once again, I repeat, the Muslim Brotherhood has been around since 1928. They have learned a lot of lessons. They've learned from the Nazis, they've learned from the communists, they've learned from their own mistakes. The secular groups that are pro-democratic and liberal, not only in Egypt but in the Arab world, have found themselves over and over again in situations where they've trusted the Brotherhood and that trust was betrayed. I don't think that they should repeat that mistake. I think they should go about organizing and creating structures that are able to compete with the structures that the Muslim Brotherhood have established.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, my guest on WNYC, author of Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations. And she has an article on Huffington Post and in the International Herald Tribune called Get Ready to Compete with with the Muslim Brotherhood. And you propose a third way, as you call it, that involves saying yes to Islam, but no to Sharia law. Is that the main structure that you're referring to?
Absolutely. And that is when I would trust the spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood if they were to admit that there is a political dimension to Islam and that they would cut off and would be willing to cut off that political branch of Islam. That would mean the two other, the social and the spiritual dimension of Islam would remain. Islam as a source of faith, a personal faith, Islam as a source of tolerance. And that would require a farewell from Sharia law, from the dream of the caliphate. It would require, very clear scriptural revisions. It would require a revision of the Prophet Muhammad as an example for all time, and it would require for Muslims in Muslim-majority countries to design constitutions that protect, in the future, that protect societies from elements of the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, like, anyway, groups that want to introduce Sharia.
So after this historic and moving and popular overthrow of Mubarak that's taking place, any organization of a new constitution will presumably include, you know, debates around what you were just saying, the role of religion in the constitution of a new Egypt. Plus, any new party will have to have more of a program, I would imagine, than being for or against Sharia law. They'll need a vision for jobs for young people, maybe first and foremost, and other down-to-earth public needs. So I imagine there's more to successfully competing with the Muslim Brotherhood than finding a way to say yes to Islam but no to Sharia law.
Yes, and I think that this is the hope. The secular, liberal groups in Egypt and in other places in the Arab world can design a program, a political program, that addresses the economic needs of their society. The needs of, you know, their own foreign policy. Islamist foreign policy is an aggressive foreign policy. Look at Iran, the development of nuclear weapons, declaration of war, this constant turmoil. And such a program would take into account how do we relate to our neighbors and other countries. It would be a program that would spell out what individual liberties are and how they can and should be protected. So in a way, they are very strong, and history is on their side. And I believe that America can help a long way, but they do have to admit that there is an incompatibility between political Islam and their desires for freedom and economic prosperity.
Here, too, even in terms of secular services, the Muslim Brotherhood has a head start, don't they, as they did in Kenya in the 80s, according to your article, being already ingrained in communities, providing social services and other vital needs where the government falls down. How much do you think that is the case, and how much do you think that matters?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood's civic activism and service provision is legendary, and the secular groups have to start from scratch, some of them. But before they can do that, they have to agree on at least a few objectives. And what we now call development aid, the $1.5 billion that America gives on an annual basis to Egypt, can be used to build that infrastructure of civic institutions and economic institutions so that the liberals are able to compete, the true liberals are able to compete with the Brotherhood in an election. And the best thing to happen to Egypt would be for the Brotherhood to be defeated at the ballot box over and over again.
How do you feel in general about the Egyptian revolution, by the way? As a democracy advocate, as someone from Africa, as a human being, are you inspired and moved and exhilarated by this, as so many people are?
I am inspired and moved and exhilarated by it. Obviously, coming where I come from, I've seen many, many demonstrations and many protests, civic protests in Muslim countries that ended up in disappointment. So I'm more cautious in jubilating and, for instance, in believing that the Muslim Brotherhood has changed its colors. But I'm very, very optimistic, and I really think the future of Egypt and other Arab Islamic countries does not necessarily have to be the two extremes of either a strong man tyrant type, you know, the Mubarak type regime, or a Sharia type regime like Iran. There is a third way, and this, I see this as a great opportunity to organize and to inspire the liberal democratic forces in Egypt. And here is where the West can help.
We have a few minutes left with Ayan Hirsi Ali, author of Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations. And before I ask you about the foundation you're starting here in New York with the John Jay College for Criminal Justice to protect women and girls from actions inspired by political Islam, let me take a few phone calls for you, 212-433-WNYC. Calls are coming in. Jawad in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Brian.
Go ahead, Jawad. Right to your point.
Right. Well, I wanted to say that the madam over here, she's talking against Islam. However, there's a lot of, in most places where Islam has been implemented in the name of Sharia law and has been heavily influenced by culture of the place. However, when Sharia law in itself is looked at from the Quran and from the traditions of Holy Prophet, it is not as oppressive as people call it.
You're saying that Taliban Sharia law is Taliban, and somebody else's Sharia law may not be like that?
Exactly.
Can you give a more positive example?
Well, for example, a lot of times honor killings are associated with Sharia law, which are totally against Sharia law. Sharia law doesn't have very extreme punishments, such as if a person steals, their hand is to be cut. If a person cheats on their wife, or a woman cheats on her husband, she's to be stoned to death. These things in a lot of places happen where they are already very misogynistic cultures. However, Islamically, it has to be proven by four eyewitnesses who have seen the intercourse taking place. And that is very hard to prove. However, once the punishment is implemented, it is a lesson for all, because a person cheating on their spouse not just destroys the relationship, but it actually destroys the whole family. And the children are to grow up without one of their parents, and it has very lasting effect. That's why the punishment is so severe.
Joette, I'm going to leave it there for time, but I guess, Ayan, you see what you're up against.
Yeah, this is indeed a fantastic demonstration of how muddled people are, particularly Muslims, about what Sharia law is and what it entails once it's implemented. And what I find fascinating, and I note all the time, is the assertion that Sharia law, whether it's implemented in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in Afghanistan, or even in Nigeria, that people like the young man who called in always say, but then they're all wrong. It must be something else. Sharia law must be different. The outcome must be different. And that rationalization, that denial, unfortunately, is deeply held, and it's very strong. But I think there is one lesson we can learn from those who have actually lived under Sharia law, like the Iranian Green Movement of 2009. Those young people do not want Sharia law. And I think it's bad for Egypt. It's bad for anyone. And it is now time to start a movement that says no to Sharia law and yes to freedom, and perhaps reduce Islam to its spiritual dimension.
Ziad in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there, Brian. You know, it's really interesting that she speaks about how progressive liberals should have a major say. I mean, in America, we have a very significant, maybe 50% of our nation happens to be conservative. Maybe over 100 million Americans don't believe in abortion rights. Those are things that she would be against. But she doesn't knock America. She only wants to knock Islamic regimes. Also, she talks about Iran getting a nuclear weapon. Well, how many countries in the world have a nuclear weapon? Are they all bad, too? I don't think that she sets the standard fairly across the board. She pigeonholes and tries to attack Islam at every turn. And I think that's the problem with a lot of her philosophy. And, you know, Egypt is not a liberal place. It's more of a conservative place due to their predominantly Islamic heritage.
But, Ziad, are you equating opposition to abortion with the conservative position in that context of, say, stoning women to death for adultery?
No, I'm equating, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood to the evangelist right in America, where we have over 30 to 50 million people who are evangelists, right? And they have a very, very extreme and conservative view. So why doesn't she knock them as well as the Muslim Brotherhood?
Ziad, I'm going to leave it there. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, do you knock them as well?
I knock them, but remember, the United States of America has a constitution, and it has a political infrastructure of checks and balances. And the evangelicals can compete, but they cannot turn the system upside down because there are safeguards within the system against anti-democratic, whether they are theocratic or not, but anti-democratic autocratic, you know, takeover of power. That is not the case in Egypt. That's not the case in any of the Arab Islamic world. And we have to have, I mean, we're talking about Egypt. Egyptians have to think through how to design a constitution that can do the same for them and for Egyptians.
One more. Ahmad in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ahmad.
Yes, sir. How are you? I like your show, and very educated and informative.
Thank you,
and
sir.
And let me tell you about Pakistan, because I'm from Pakistan. Pakistan has two laws. One is a British law, and one is a Sharia law. It's both is implemented in the court. And
so they can coexist in some way, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Whatever is superseding each other, they are implementing that one. Let me give you another example for General Ziaul Haq. When he became a power as a dictator, he used a Sharia. At that time, America did not say any single word. And he is punishing people openly, and using the Sharia law.
Ahmed, thank you very much. So I don't know if you're familiar, Ayaan, with some idea of British law and Sharia law coexisting in Pakistan. I don't know which would take precedence if they conflict, or the United States or the West supporting Zia al-Haq when he ran Pakistan and imposed Sharia law.
Well, the West has mistakenly supported very many bad leaders in Muslim countries, and whatever British law was in Pakistan is hollowed out. And it is hollowed out by movements like the Muslim Brotherhood that wanted to implement Sharia in Pakistan. And Pakistan is now a complete, it's a basket case of terror and tyranny and poverty. And I don't think that the caller who called in now wants the future of Egypt to look like the present of Pakistan.
And I'm going to move on because we're really over our time already. But I do want you to be able to get a word in about your foundation, your AHA, your initials, Foundation here in New York, going to conduct a research project with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice to try and measure the number of crimes against women committed here in New York in the name of Islam. Do I have that right?
Well, we are starting initially with in the name of Islam, but we want to focus also on tribal customs. So, as you know, I am opposed to multiculturalism, and what the foundation's mission is to inform and create awareness about all kinds of crimes committed against women in the name of religion and culture.
When you say you're opposed to multiculturalism, that's a big statement.
If you take multiculturalism as a word describing the fact that a society is made up of many cultures, that is just purely descriptive, and I'm not against it. I'm against the theory that cultures within a liberal society, different cultures, can coexist, where minority cultures can break the law, abuse women's rights, be intolerant toward their members of their own gay community, and get away with it in the name of culture or religion.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, her book now out in paperback is Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations. And she has an article in the International Herald Tribune and on Huffington Post called Get Ready to Compete with the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt could chart a third way. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we have an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific poll question on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. Should the U.S. withdraw its support from the insiders' transition to democracy now being led in Egypt by Vice President Suleiman there? Should the U.S. withdraw its support now that it's coming under criticism for backing the insiders leading the transition? Go to our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, and register your response. We'll talk more about Egypt later in the show, but coming up next, a reality check before we get too far away from the Super Bowl about new data regarding concussions and other football injuries. This is not about pro players so much as it's about your neighbors and your kids. Stay with us.